persons. They are so straightforward that I'm covering several of them. This has a disadvantage that the lecture turns into a bit of a catalogue of here's one thing, here's another, here's another. I'll try to avoid too much of that, but we have to get through it somehow. There's something of a surprise towards the end anyway, so we'll wake up then, if not before. Okay, so let's get going. First of all, let me reintroduce or remind you of what is an abstract data type. A data type is what its name suggests, you know, a type that holds data. Well, surprise, surprise. Abstract means that we're not worrying about details of implementation and so on. We are simply specifying what we expect of this thing, rather than how this thing does things for us. So it's, if you like, a specification language for data structures, and it would consist of a mathematical model of the data, and that can get as formal as you like. There are highly formalized theories of data specification. We shan't go into those, but we will stick to a fairly, informal level. And also, along with that specification of the data, or the model of the data rather, methods for accessing and modifying the data. If you haven't got any of those, then it's not much use to you. Okay. What an ATD does not specify, though, is how the data should be organized in memory, or it may suggest how, but it doesn't insist on how. Okay. So it's a contract that says it will supply you this kind of thing, but not how it will do it. Okay. And it doesn't insist on which algorithms will be used to implement the methods. Again, that's on the other side of the contract, so to speak. Okay. So, if you go out there and buy a television set, all you care about is that it will receive television channels, and if you press the right buttons, it does the right things. What the circuitry inside is, you couldn't care less, as long as it works. Right? It's this kind of thing. Of course, the advantage of this is that if you're a programmer out there wanting to do a certain job, and you know that you need your data to be held to do a certain thing, you look for the appropriate data structure and you import the package and you use it. You don't need to worry yourself about the details of how that package works. And if at a certain stage you need a more efficient version of the job, so this data package does the job well enough for now, but it turns out you need to scale it up. Yeah, get out of the way. Scale it up and make it bigger and bigger. And you need more and more efficient implementations. Well, all you need to do is import the implementation. The rest of your software doesn't change. It's just the familiar notion of abstraction and high-level programming. Okay, so nothing very difficult going on here. Just the obvious way of division of concerns, if you like. Okay. So an ADT, if you like, is the what, not the how of what happens. Okay. In terms of the how part, of course, and we are concerned about this in this class. Okay, the what, if you like, would be what you'd be concerned with in a class on, say, programming methodologies, etc., etc. Okay, here we would be worrying about collections of variables to store the data. So we're at the other end of the contract, actually trying to supply this thing that does this specified job. Okay? And of course, algorithms for the methods of the data of the ADT. Okay. In terms of Java, to put it in more familiar terms, an ADT is rather like a Java interface that just says, it does this kind of thing. And the data structure is an actual Java class; it actually does the stuff. Okay. Is that a familiar concept from? Yeah. Okay. Good. Right. So, it's an idea that has been around for a very long time. It's nothing new. Okay, it doesn't originate with Java, I must stress. This is way before. Okay, and of course, the data structure with the algorithms is going to have a large influence on the algorithmic efficiency, and that's what we're particularly concerned with in this class. Okay, I must stress that, when I say these things, I'm not saying, therefore, nothing else matters, or this is the most important thing. It is one important thing, and we should therefore study it. That's all I'm saying with that. Okay. So the first one, a remarkably simple data structure with a remarkable range of uses. It's perhaps one of the most fundamental ones in computing, which is the stack. And here we just have, the data could be anything really, okay? But a stack holds one particular type of data. So it could be a stack of integers, a stack of strings, a stack of classes, whatever, okay? So the data could be whatever you specify, okay? And there are three operations. One is to push an item of data onto the stack. Okay, so I'm assuming here that we've got a stack and these methods are attached to the class of the stack, so to speak. So implied in this is that there is a stack you have specified. Okay, otherwise it's meaningless. Okay, it might be better to have parameterized to say push E onto the stack S, but I hope you understand that there's a stack around here and we're doing this onto that stack. Okay, right. So push means just insert the element E onto the stack. Whatever this thing is, it will now have this data, item of data in it, okay? Pop removes the most recently pushed element from the stack, okay? So whatever was the last thing to go in there now comes out, okay? And is no longer in the stack. It's returned by this operation, and it is no longer in the stack, okay? Of course, if there were several copies of this data item, it's the most recently pushed copy that is returned. The other copies stay. Okay. and if the stack is empty, though, then it is an error to call pop, okay, because there's nothing to return, and you're asking to return something. Okay. And therefore, we need a method to tell us if we're about to have an error, and the method is empty, returns true if the stack is empty and false otherwise, which makes sense. Okay. So that's all you have for a stack, but it is incredibly useful as a data structure. And another name for it is a last in, first out queue, for obvious reasons. Okay. Now, there are various implementations of a stack that we could use. All of them with excellent worst case performance, all of them with constant worst case performance. We can use either arrays or linked lists as being typical. Okay. If you use arrays, you need to have a reasonable idea of how big your stack is likely to get. Otherwise, you may run out of space. But otherwise, it's an excellent way of implementing a stack. We'll see a way of getting around that difficulty later on, okay, with the arrays. If you use linked lists, then, of course, your only limit is just the absolute limit of your computer memory. Okay. The reason we do so well, of course, is simply because all these operations are incredibly simple. There's nothing very complicated going on. You just put something there, you bring it back. Okay, you don't do much with it. Okay, basically, it's a way of remembering stuff and remembering it in some kind of time sequence. You remember the most recent things first, then the next recent, then the next recent, and so on. Okay, if you think of this is probably going. I don't know. Do they still have stacks of plates in cafeterias? Yeah, you push it on, you take it off. Yeah, it's that kind of thing. That's the idea. Okay. Now, applications of stacks, executing recursive programs, absolutely ubiquitous application of it. Your recursive procedure needs to be falling apart. Okay, hang on a minute. I'm just trying to get this thing on again, sorry. That seems all right. Okay. It needs to call itself recursively on a different version of the data. And when it returns, of course, it needs to remember what state it was in. So what does it do? It creates an activation record, pushes it onto the stack, and then calls itself. Yeah? When it exits, it pops the last activation record off the stack. Yeah? So that's, you know. But without that discipline, you couldn't really have recursive procedures, which would be rather a shame, because then your programming abilities would be rather curtailed. Depth-first search on a graph, we will see that later on, okay, a really important use of stacks. Evaluating postfix arithmetic expressions is a simple example which we'll look at now. Now, a postfix arithmetic expression, I'm not sure if that's new to you. Is that new to most of you, the idea of postfix? Some shaking, some nodding. Okay, so it's a very simple idea. In postfix notation, we give the arguments of the operation first and then the operation. That's it, hence the name. Okay. how difficult is that? What's the advantage of that? The advantage is that by the time you need to do the operation, you already know the arguments. Okay. And all you need to do is just push off the arguments and apply the operation to them. And now you push the result back onto your memory. Okay. And another advantage is it doesn't need any bracketing. Okay. There's no need for brackets at all. So expressions given in postfix notation can be evaluated rather quickly. I'll give you an example just now. Okay. So if we look at the example at the bottom and then we'll look at this bit of pseudocode, down here, that's visible. Okay. What this is saying is the first argument is 6, the next is 4, and the operation is minus. So that's to be understood as the first thing you do is 6 minus 4. And now you remember that result. Okay, that's an argument to be supplied to another operation. And then it says, oh, there's another argument 3. So now we've got 6 minus 4 and 3. And what do you do to those two results? Oh, you multiply them. So that's now single results. Okay, yep. And now, oh, there's another argument. So it's whatever this has evaluated to and 10. And there's an operation. It says, what do you do to those two things? Add them. Okay, that's your next. Is that pretty clear thing, yeah? You know, very simple idea, but nevertheless very effective, because if you compile expressions down to this form, evaluating them is very fast, as we'll see. Okay, here is a simple algorithm for evaluating such a postfix expression. Okay, I'm going to assume that my operations are just addition, subtraction, multiplication, division, but they could be anything. They don't have to be just two argument operations. They could be arbitrary, as long as you know how many arguments the operation expects. Okay. But just to keep it simple, we'll assume that it's just a straightforward arithmetic expression. Okay, so suppose I'm given a sequence like this. Okay, so it's either a number or it's one of the symbols plus, minus, star, or divide. Okay, S1, S2, up to SK. To evaluate it, all I do is the following. I should have a loop here. My apologies. Okay. I go, you know, I read off the numbers, SIs, S1, S2, S3, S4, SK, okay? Yeah. So if the current thing I'm looking at from this sequence is a number, I push it onto the stack. It's an argument to be remembered. I'm waiting for the operation. Okay, I don't know what to do with it yet, but it'll come in when an operation comes in. Okay. Otherwise, SI is a binary operation in this example, okay? In which case, it needs two arguments, okay? And it's the last two arguments that went onto the stack, okay? So I pop E2 off the I pop the stack and store it in E2. I pop the stack again and store that in E1, okay? So first argument was the last, not the most recent, but the next most recent one. Second argument is the most recent argument to go onto that. I now apply the operation to them in that order, E1, SI, E2. That's important, of course, because if it's a subtraction, then it matters which way around you write the arguments. If it's an addition, it doesn't matter. Okay, so you need to get this the right way around. Okay, so E1, SI, E2. That gives me a number which I push back onto the stack. Okay. And now I just carry on reading this sequence. Okay. Very clear, I hope. Very simple example. Let's do this example here. I'll do it on the board. Okay, and there's an example of this on the exercise sheet for you to try. And they link to some kind person has written an applet on the web which you can use to experiment. Yes.
Is the turn outside the for loop?
Yes. Thank you. Yes. Yeah. I should have. I don't know why I never spotted that before, but yes. Yeah. This thing here is once we've finished reading our sequence, then assuming that the sequence was well formed. Which this does assume that, then what remains on the stack is just the final result, as we'll see with this example. Okay, so let's do that. Okay, let's do this example. So here's my stack starts off being empty. Okay, but then the first thing I do is I see a 6, so I push it onto the stack. Inconveniently, we tend to draw stacks top down, so I need to give myself a bit of room. Okay, I put it onto here because I want to be able to push stuff on the top. Okay, can everybody see that? Yeah. Okay. Yeah. The next thing I see is a 4, so it gets pushed onto the stack. Okay. The next thing I see is a minus, so these come off, and I apply the minus, okay, in that order. So that gives me a 2. My stack is now empty. I push this result which is a 2, onto my stack. So I get now a stack consisting of 2 only. Okay? The next thing I see is a 3, so that gets pushed onto the stack. Okay? Now I see an operation, a star, so I need to pop these off the stack. And it's 3 is the second argument, 2 is the first argument, and I do the operation in that order, but it wouldn't matter here because star is commutative. Okay? The result is 6, so that gets pushed onto the stack. Okay. I now see another argument, which is a 10. And you get the idea. Okay? Now, this is a very simple example. So the stack tends to become empty and then stuff on it. In a very complicated example, there could be all sorts of things on the stack partway through, waiting to be evaluated. Okay? That's perfectly possible. Okay? But it's a very simple idea. We can test if the expression is well-formed, okay, simply because if you ever try to pop something off the stack and there's nothing on there, the expression was badly formed. You haven't given enough arguments for an operation. Okay? And if at the end your stack has anything more than just one number on it, then your expression was again badly formed. Otherwise, it was well formed. And that's an easy result to prove. Okay? So that's a nice simple application of stacks. And as I say, you can see that if you've compiled a complicated parenthesized expression down to this form, it's going to be very fast to evaluate. If you've got to evaluate it lots of times, then it's very efficient. Yes?
Can you convert every possible bracketed expression?
Yes, 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 you can. And there's a simple algorithm to do it as well, but you might like to work it out in your time, but it is perfectly possible, yes. Very simple recursive algorithm. Okay. But I just give this as a nice little example of application of stacks. But, okay. Now, queues are essentially a similar idea to stacks, but with a different discipline in terms of the time ordering of data on them. Okay. So here, again, we can put an item of data onto the queue. Surprise, surprise. We can remove an item of data onto the queue, and this time we remove the one that was there for the longest time, so the oldest item gets removed. Okay. And again, if the queue is empty, then it is an error to try and remove something from it. And again, we have a test for whether the queue is empty. Okay. So almost the same as a stack, but different discipline as to which thing comes off. Okay. And these are called first in, first out sometimes. But if somebody just says queue, they mean one of these things. If they say stack, they mean a stack, okay? But alternative names are, as I say, first in, first out for this, and first last in, first out for the stacks, okay? Those are older names, actually. Okay. Now, again, just as with a stack, you can implement the queue very simply using either arrays or linked lists. Again, with arrays, if you don't have a realistic idea of how long your queue is going to grow, then you run the risk of running out of space. There are things we can do about that. And with the linked list, the same comments apply as to the stack. Okay. And the cost of operations, as you might have guessed, again, they're all constant. Okay. Not exactly a surprise. I mean, the operations don't do very much. They just put something there, take it off. That's all they do. Okay. Those examples are examples of data kept in some kind of sequence. There's some kind of ordering on the data as it comes in and goes out. Okay, and we can give a mathematical model of what we mean by sequential data. And I'm not going to do a lot with this, but it's good to introduce you to these ideas at some stage. So here's an introduction, basically. So what do we mean by sequence or sequential data? Well, a sequence has to have a well-defined, these are finite sequences for us. This is computing, so you can't store an infinite list of stuff. It's got to be a finite number of things. So a sequence will have a well-defined first element and a well-defined last element. Okay? Every element of a sequence except the last will have a unique successor, and every element except the first will have a unique predecessor. Okay. That's what we would require. And then we define the rank of an element E in a sequence to be the number of elements before that element. Okay. So the first three are requirements, the last is a definition from these things. Okay? And of course, stacks and queues are examples of sequential data, as are lots of other things. Okay? just a little diagrammatic convention, which I would imagine you've seen before, but just in case. We tend to draw these data structures, such as arrays and lists, in an abstract sort of way. The array, you have already drawn a few arrays on the board, and it's hardly a surprise. It's a sequence of locations, so you just draw them 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on. So that would be an example of an array diagram. For linked lists, it depends on whether it's a singly linked list or a doubly linked list. Singly linked means that you have a bit that holds a bit of data, and then a pointer that says that's where the next bit of data is, and then a pointer that says that's where the next bit of data is, and so on. Okay, so this is a singly linked list that says, okay, O1 is held here, and where do you find the next item in the list? Well, you go to this paired thing with this O1, and it's a pointer that says go over there, and when you go over there, oh, there's the next item of data. Now, if there's any more data, where do you find it? Well, you go there, it says go here, and so on, until you reach the end, in which this case, this pointer is null. It points nowhere, so you know you've reached the end. Is that fairly familiar? Yeah, okay, good, great. Okay, and for doubly linked list, same idea, but you have forwards and backward pointers. Okay, yes? Well, you might hold this in various ways, okay, but it's not part of the... Yeah. Pardon? Sorry? Do you mean this one?
Yeah.
There's nothing before. This would be the previous pointer. There's no preceding element. Yeah. And likewise here, there's no succeeding element. Yes. Well, otherwise your data structure entirely no. But there is, because this tells you there is nothing before me. Okay. Yeah, and this tells you there's nothing after me. Okay. Yeah. I know it looks like wasting space, but remember, it's just a pointer. It's not a big thing. Yeah. But there's also another purpose in that this is entirely uniform as a data structure now. Okay. Good. Do please ask questions like that, because I want to avoid any misunderstandings. Okay. Has that clarified your point?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Right. Of course, these are abstract diagrams. What happens in memory is more like this. For an array, it's not so different from what we draw as a diagram. But for a list, it could be quite a, you know, the data could be all over the place. So which diagram do you prefer, this one and this one, or the two previous ones? Okay, I think I know which ones I prefer. Okay, so this gives a lie to the idea that the more information you have, the better it is. Okay, sometimes less information is better. You know, yes. This is more information, if you like, but it's irrelevant to more information. Okay, the previous abstract diagram is less information, but much better, more usable, less information. It's not that you want more information, you want more useful information. Okay, you might bear that in mind. Okay, so that was just to make sure that we're all synchronized on these diagrams. Just nothing clever going on. Now, moving on to another useful kind of data structure of a sequential form, vectors are a very commonly used kind of structure. So this is rather like an array, but one that you can grow or shrink. Okay. So that has implications for how you can implement the thing. Okay, I'm not going to go through all of these in detail, because they're all really pretty simple ideas. But the notion of vector is you've got you can get the element of a given rank. You can replace an element of a given rank. You can insert a brand new element for a given rank, so that expands the vector. You can replace an element of a given rank, so that shrinks it. Okay. And of course, you can get the size of your vector. Okay, I won't read through all those definitions, because you're all capable of reading it for yourself from the notes. Okay, it's not crucial just now to go through all of those. Okay, fairly simple idea, which I hope is also reasonably familiar to you. Okay, I just want to place it on record as a fact. Okay, now how might we implement a vector? Well, we could use an array. Arrays are a very attractive a way of implementing stuff, because of the fact that you can access elements at random for the same cost. Okay, that's the beauty of arrays. Okay, of course, the problem with them is that having grabbed yourself an array, it's of a given size, and you can't be guaranteed to be able to grow it cheaply, because the next bit of memory may now be taken up. Okay, we'll have to address that. Okay, but for now, let's just look at implementing a vector using an array and face the music as to what happens if you run out of space. Okay, so we would declare an array A for storing the elements of our vector, and we would keep an integer n to indicate the size of the vector so far, because the array we've declared is presumably big enough so that we can store any vector we might be likely to store. So the actual size of the vector may be different from the size of the array. It's only grown so far, and it may be shrinking and then growing and shrinking and growing. Okay, so we need something else to tell us how big the vector is. So we hold that in a separate variable, which we'll call n. Okay. Now the methods are all pretty simple. Element at rank r is pretty obviously. You just return a of r. And that's the right thing. Remember, rank r means there are r elements before me, but we number arrays from 0. So the element of rank r in an array numbered from 0 upwards really is at position r. If you number the arrays starting from 1, then the element of rank r will be at position r minus 1. Okay. But just a loose subtlety of the definition, but nothing very clever going on. Okay. Replacing an element of rank r by a new element d is a very obvious assignment, so nothing very clever going on, absolute triviality. Yeah. Now, inserting an element e at rank r, well, it's a very obvious thing to do. What do you need to do? You've got this array which has elements in it, and you want to insert something here. Well, you just move everything from here upwards one place to create a position, and you insert a new element in the place. And that's what this loop does, okay? And then we update the size of our vector as the last thing we do, okay? Of course, this implementation, this bit of pseudocode here is going to come into severe trouble if the array runs out of space. Okay? So this assumes that we haven't run out of space. We'll address that later on. Okay. And for remove an element at rank r, you do the obvious thing. You just shift the stuff above you down by one place, and that way you've deleted this element. Okay. Now, this will not run into trouble, of course. And then the size, that's just return the variable n. Okay. So what are the costs of this? Assuming everything goes well, we have one problem that we need to address at some stage, but assuming that that's okay, well, the runtimes are pretty obvious. For element at rank, replace at rank and size, it's just constant cost. You're either just writing something into the position of the array, or you're returning the variable n. Okay? For insertion at a certain position and removing from a certain position, well, you may be faced with moving all the elements of your vector either up by one place or down by one place. Okay? Now, your vector has size n when you call this operation, so you may be forced to move n elements either up by one or down by one, so your cost is going to be theta n in the worst case. Right. Pretty obvious, yeah? Okay. Before I address that, I'm not going to go through all this, so relax, okay? But this is just to show how, you know, these things can conglomerate. A list we can think of as a sequential abstract data type with the following slew of methods, okay, all of which are pretty obvious as to what they do. But because lists are so useful and so widely used, it's worth placing it on record, and that there's a kind of generally agreed set of operations that they should have. Okay, they're all pretty obvious. Okay. As operations, okay. So I won't go through them in any detail, and there are even some more that people tend to use. Okay, okay. Well, fair enough. but I'm going to discuss this a little bit, and rather than go through this entire slew of stuff, I'll just discuss some of them, you know, as we go along. Okay. now, the idea of a list is that you're referring to elements of the list by means of a pointer, okay? And you're generally using a list by, you start at the head of the list, and you move along by one, then by another, then by another, and so on. So they're always saying, I am there, I am there, I am there, I am there. Yeah. If what you want is to be able to jump all over the place in your data structure, a list is entirely the wrong thing to employ. Okay. It's just not going to work for you. Okay. Now, so in our implementation, as I say, positions are realized by nodes having filled element previous and next. The element is what the list is holding for you. Previous is what's before me, if there's anything before me. And next is what's after me, if there's anything after me. Okay. Using null pointers to indicate there's nothing to look at. Okay. And we access the list by having two separate variables which point to the first element of the list and the last element of the list. Okay. So if you think of it in the diagram, I'll just grab this out. I'm not going to try and give absolute complete details on these things because they're so simple and they're in the notes. I'll leave you to read them for yourselves. I'm just going to point to a few things, okay? So in the diagrammatic way that we had it before, if this is our list represented diagrammatically, and so on, we hold two separate variables, first and last, one pointing to there and the other one pointing to over here. Okay. Now, suppose we've moved along the list and we're at some position P, let's say here, we're somewhere in the middle. So let me just draw a separate diagram. We're somewhere in the middle. So P is pointing to this element of the list here, and we want to insert something at that position. What can we do? What does it cost us to do it? Well, the answer is it costs us very little, actually constant time, because all we need to do is create a new node. Okay. Put the element into the new node, so put it into there, okay, and then I should have drawn these links here. Okay, we want to put this after P, so we need to arrange for these pointers to be moved about. Okay, now the only subtlety here is to not to do the pointers in the wrong order. Okay, so the order in which these pointers are rearranged is important. Otherwise, you might lose the link. Typically. If you've done it the wrong way, you've lost how to get to, say, this element because you've already reassigned this pointer too early, okay? That kind of thing. But otherwise, there's nothing clever going on. I'll leave you to read that for yourselves. So with that caveat, okay, just draw a little diagram like that and follow the way the pointers are moving about, and you'll see that it's really quite simple. Okay, I trust it's pretty obvious that this is nothing terribly clever. But there is that classic programmer's error of doing the pointers the wrong way around, and then the compiler says at that runtime says there's nothing there, I can't point to it. Okay, it's because you've lost the pointer, you did it too early, you assigned it to the wrong thing. Okay, so read that with that little subtlety in mind. Okay, likewise for removing an element. What do you have to do? Basically, just rearrange the pointers and just forget the element you've removed. Just let it go to garbage collection. Okay. The running times, if we're using a doubly linked implementation, as I'm indicating here, are all just constant time because you're only just moving about a few pointers. That's all you ever do. Okay. And that's only because we're always pointing to where we want to be. We don't have to search for where we want to do the operation. We are there and we're saying, do it right here. Okay. And what you're asked to do is just something very simple. Okay. If you wanted to search your data structure for items of the data, a list is entirely the wrong thing. Okay. because you can only travel, you know, one thing at a time. Even if the list is sorted, it's no good to you just by itself. You can't do binary search on a list in a, by any efficient way. You can do it, but it's entirely inefficient. Yeah? Because you've no way of going to the middle and saying, drop that, okay? If you had the list which was sorted and you suddenly decided, I need to search it, you could copy it into an array and now do binary search. Okay? But make sure you understand why you couldn't do binary search efficiently on a list. If you don't believe me, implement it in Java and time it, and you'll see. Okay? But there's a cheaper way to see it, which is to use your brain. Okay, it's also more fun. Okay, but maybe I reveal my prejudices that way. Okay, time to face the music. I wanted to make sure I left enough time for this. Okay, we've seen several times you can use an array, but only if you've got enough space. Now, in some applications, you might want to implement vectors or stacks or whatever. You have an idea. You know that your data structure will never grow more than this big, whatever this may be. Okay, in which case that's fine. You can declare an array of that size, as long as it's not a ridiculous size, and excellent. Okay, but in other cases you can't have such an idea. You can know that it starts off reasonably sized, and it might grow big, it might not. You don't know. Okay, so what can you do there? Well, one solution is to use what are called dynamic arrays. So let's see what these are and what they buy us. Okay. It says we'll implement very basic. This is just a made-up data structure to illustrate this idea. Okay. Basically, it's just like a vector. We can put elements of rank R, we can replace an element of rank R, we can insert an element at the end of the of the sequence, and we can return the size. Okay, I want an insertion. The other stuff is not important. The fact that I can insert is the point, because I want it to be able to grow and therefore become too big. Okay, what this data structure is exactly is not that relevant. It's to illustrate the notion of dynamic array. That's what I want you to focus on here. In the notes, this is all written out. Okay, so okay, here's the notion of dynamic array. Okay, if you ask me to insert an element into my data structure, an array, I'm using an array to implement it. Okay, remember, n holds the number of items of my data structure. Okay, so if n is smaller than the length of the array, then I've got room, so I just do the insertion. So that's the nice case where I haven't run into trouble yet. Okay. Otherwise, I've run into trouble because the array is already full and you want me to insert something into it. What do I do apart from signal an error? Okay. Well, what I do is I work out the length of my array and double that, store it into n. Remember, the length of the array is a dot length plus 1 because arrays are numbered from 0, 1, 2, 3. So it goes from A not A1 up to length minus 1. So I need to add 1 to this to get the actual length of the array. Okay. So this number n now stores something which is twice the length of the current array. Okay. I now create a new array A dashed of length n. Okay. So I call on the system to give me that much memory. Okay. And now I copy the old array into the new one in the obvious way. Okay. And now, of course, I've got room to insert. Okay. Fine. Okay, so that's a very obvious idea. Why twice the length, and is this really such a good idea? Yes.
Would it be better if you just say 3 times the length?
We'll come to that. Good question, yes. So why twice and not 3 or 1.5 or, you know, yeah. There's actually nothing magical about twice. Except that computers love binary arithmetic. Yeah? So, you know, they can do multiplication by 2 just like that. Because what is it? It's just a shift. Yes? It's the fastest thing you can do on a computer. Yeah. Okay. So that's really why. Okay. But there's also a reason that it has to be some multiple of n and not just n plus 1 or n plus 2 or something. My apologies, length of array plus 1 and so on. Okay. That's what I want to address. Okay. All right. Now, is this such a good idea? Yes, it is. Why? Let's see. Well, first of all, all the operations of our data structure, this made-up data type, have theta 1 running time, except, of course, for insertion, which in the worst case has theta n running time, because in the worst case, you've got to create this new array, and then you've got to copy n items into the new array and insert another item into it. Okay? So obviously, the worst case is not that hot. You know, it's pretty bad, right? That's one point of view. And if you have an application where at any given time, any operation must be constant time, then this is not going to do it for you. Okay? But plenty of applications are the kind where they run for a long time, okay, and what you care about is the overall performance over that sequence of operations, not just any one operation. It so happens that one operation takes a bit more time than others, but the overall cost is actually really good, then what do you care? Right? Okay. And this is exactly the right thing for that. Okay. we're going to do what's called an amortized analysis of this situation and see that if what we do is just count the cost over a sequence of operations, not just of one individual operation, then it is as though every operation is constant time. Even though the odd operation costs time proportional to n, if you look at this over a long period of time, those are just little blips which don't show up in the overall runtime, really. They're just kind of absorbed, okay, which is rather interesting. Okay. So here's the theorem that we want to prove. Inserting m elements into an initially empty version of this data structure, basically, we just think of dynamic array. Okay. Yeah. Inserting m elements into dynamic array using the method insert last takes theta m time. Well, that's rather like, you know, each one costs theta 1 time. You know, it's m of them. So what does each one of them cost? It looks like it's constant. We know some of them cost constant time, some of them cost more than constant time. But overall, it's as though they're all constant. Okay. Now, here's the proof. Except forget this because it's in the notes. Okay. Let's see why we might think this is the case and why we would believe this. Okay. I'll need to just rub this off. Okay. Now, what happens with a dynamic array? Okay. You're running along fine, and then every now and then you've got to create something twice your size. Okay. A lot of operations, just look at the insert operations, they're cheap because they don't have to create this big array. Okay. And now comes the call and says, insert this element E, and it so happens you've run out of luck. So this insert operation is faced with this situation of having to create an array double the size, copy everything, and then proceed. Okay. That's a bit unlucky, isn't it? All these other lucky sods before it, it's been constant time. And what's worse, so I've got this array that was of size whatever, okay? I've run out of luck. I am this operation that's been told you've got to do this thing, okay? You've got to grow this array to twice the size. Okay. Then insert, okay? And then, so suppose this had k things in it, okay? After I get inserted here, the other k operations that come after me, pretty much, don't worry about the exact, it's around k, right? Okay? They get to have cheap insert operations. They don't pay any price. I did all the work, yeah? But they get the benefit, right? I had to pay the cost of this growing, and they just ride on my back for free. So I refuse. I say, no, I'm not going to do that. This may sound a bit familiar from your parents. No, no. I ain't doing it. I'll tell you what. I'll grow the array if you people after me share the cost. If you agree to face the cost, I accept that I've got to pay constant time to be inserted into this array. Let's normalize the cost of insertion to 1. Okay, it doesn't matter, yeah? Okay? Right? I agree to pay a price of 1 unit because everybody has to pay that anyway. So that's fair, right? But I'm not going to grow the array unless you lot coming after me agree to pay your fair share of the price. Right? Have you had this conversation with your parents yet? Well, you will. Okay. Yeah? Well, what's their fair share of the price? So I'm paying a unit of one cost so far, but to grow it costs an extra k. Okay, these figures aren't exact. You have to do the arithmetic book, but it's roughly that, okay? Yeah? So there's an extra cost of k to be paid, okay? This is actually exact figures because it's k of these things that got copied, okay? So it cost me k to copy them, right? Then I pay one to be inserted. I don't mind that. And now these other guys who are going to get cheap insertions, they agree to pay a cost of one anyway because they have to do that anyway. And now they have to pay their fair share of this insertion, of this growth. Okay. So how much does each of these people have to pay extra over and above their unit cost to cover this extra cost of k?
One
at most, yeah? In fact, it's slightly less than one, okay? Yeah? Do you see? So if you spread the cost of the operation over a sequence, okay, they all pay roughly 1 plus 1, 1 plus 1, 1 plus 1, 1 plus 1, okay? Yes? Well, that looks like a constant cost to me, to each operation, yes? That's why dynamic arrays work, right? That's a rough and ready argument of why you can expect this thing to work. And now you can see that the multiple of how much bigger this ought to be, it's really any multiple of k, right? You could have done it 3 times or 4 times or 1.5 times or whatever. You would still get a constant coming out of this, okay? Different constant, but still a constant, okay? The reason it's 2 is simply because computers love, as I say, arithmetic with 2, just multiplying by 2 is dead easy. So that's why you see so much, double it or halve it in whenever you need to do something in computer work, okay? As I say, this more detailed proof is in the notes, but that's a more intuitive explanation of what's going on. I hope that's got the idea across. That's the basic notion of these things. So just to remind you, dynamic array, if what you care about is the cost spread over a sequence of operations, they work beautifully. If you have to have a guarantee that any one operation is going to be fast, they're no good. Okay. Don't confuse the two. Okay? It is a very typical thing for people to confuse the two and therefore make a mess of anything they do. And which may explain, by the way, why so many big projects go so badly wrong, you know. People just don't insist on precise thinking. I think it's a rather good idea to think precisely. And I'm often accused of thinking too much, so. Anyway, we're finished a few minutes early. That's just the usual suggestion of reading. Next time we move on to hashing and so on, and it won't be such a catalogue of things. It'll be more one thing and we do more detail. Okay, thank you very much. See you next time. Hi.
For a list, is it not an option to keep the pointers and the data in a separate structure?
Yes, you can.
Because then you would have the advantage of it can be easily accessed for binary search. Be like an array for just the pointers.
Then it's not a list, it's another kind of data structure. But yeah, we'll see other data structures. But,
because even a dynamic. So. Inserting here takes a lot of time.
No. You're already there. No. The typical use of a list is you're traveling along, okay? And you're already there. Yes.
Yeah, but in this one, in the dynamic size, it doesn't have inserting in the middle.
It does.
Does it?
It could. Yeah. No problem. I see what you mean. Sorry. No. Apologies. No. It would cost you if you insert in the middle. Yeah. Basically, we're then discussing a different data structure, which is fine. Yeah. and we'll see those.
Okay.
Yeah. I just try not to mention too many things in Mongo. I misunderstood what you said first, but yes, for sure. For sure. But so we could use trees, we could use all kinds of things. Yeah.
Right. So there are easier ways then. Just my idea was like, Lisp is very efficient, or not efficient, but reliable.
Well, but, yeah.
Because of the double linked list, it's reliable for time.
For
randomly inserting and removing elements and searching.
Then use a tree basically. We'll get what comes.
I have a question about the worst case runtime. So last lecture, there was some algorithm. You bounded the worst case.
Yes.
Isn't this the worst case with the maximum? Isn't that worst case?
Well, yes, I really should. I was wondering about it because I heard the slides from a colleague, and then I was looking at it. Well, this is true, but I think yes.
And the worst case would be equal to that.
We could say it's that. Yes.
And also,
that's true as well, but it's just. Yeah.